for a Verdict, brought to you by Sputnik Africa.
Welcome back to Afro Verdict, the podcast that dives deep into the political, economic, and social issues shaping our continent and the world. I'm your host, Victor Anakin, and on this episode, we're turning our gaze to a global hotspot, the escalating tensions between Iran and Israel. For background info, over the weekend of April 13th, 14th, we saw Iran retaliate against Israel with a drone strike accompanied by several low-class missiles. This move came as a response to Israel attacking Iran's consulate in Syria, thereby simultaneously attacking two sovereign states. Western countries failed to condemn Iran, instead calling on Iran to avoid escalations. In the meanwhile, no one said a word to Israel, to no surprise. To help us navigate this complex situation, I'm thrilled to be joined by Mr. Naeem Jina, Executive Director of the Afro-Middle East Research Center and a renowned expert in Middle Eastern affairs. Throughout this episode, Mr. Jina will be sharing his insights on the historical roots of this conflict, the recent events that have fueled the flames, and the potential consequence for the entire region and the world. Buckle up, everyone, because this is an episode you won't want to miss. But before we dive in, a quick reminder to subscribe to the Sputnik Africa Telegram channel, where you can get the latest updates on local and global events. Now, let's get started. Mr. Jina, welcome to the AfroVerde podcast. Thank you very much for joining me today. Since you are a new guest on the program, how about a short introduction for our listeners?
My name is Naeem Jina. I'm South African. I live in Johannesburg. I'm senior researcher at a think tank in Johannesburg called Mapungubwe Institute for Strategic Reflection. Previous to that, I was the executive director of another think tank called Afro-Middle East Center. So my background in academia, I also taught politics at the University of the Witwatersrand.
Great. Well, it's a great pleasure to meet you. Thanks once again for joining. Over the weekend, we saw the Middle East go once again up in flames as we observed Iran launch a flotilla of drones at Israel. Could you perhaps analyze the factors that led to this attack?
Well, I think we should be careful about overstating what happened on Saturday night, Sunday morning. It was a very measured and carefully planned operation, if you might call it that. And done in a way that the people at the receiving end knew what was going to happen, knew what to do in order to prevent large-scale damage from taking place, etc. So it was much more of a carefully planned message than the first salvos of a war. So the intention certainly wasn't for the region to go up in flames, and it hasn't yet, unless Israel decides otherwise. But it's important, as you say, to look at why Saturday night happened and where that came from. So 2 weeks before that, on the 1st of April, Israel launched an attack against the Iranian consulate in Damascus in Syria. A number of people were killed, including senior commander of the Islamic Republic Guard Corps. But the kind of big issue here was an attack against a diplomatic facility, a consulate, which is a violation of the Vienna Convention and a violation of international law. Now, we must recall that this is not the first attack by Israel on Iranian people or Iranian installations. In Syria itself, over the past decade or so, there have been numerous attacks on Iranian bases, on Iranian military personnel, etc., by Israel, from Israel, bombing from the air. Within Iran itself, although Israel has not claimed this, but you know, most people believe that they were responsible for it. Over the past 10 years, about 16 odd nuclear scientists have been assassinated, as well as other assassinations that have taken place inside Iran, widely suspected as being Israeli operations. So all of these have taken place by Israel against Iran. Over the past 45 years, since the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979, Iran made it quite clear that the relationship with Israel would change considerably compared to what it was in, before that. The Shah of Iran before that was an ally of Israel. After the revolution, that changed. Israel was regarded as, well, basically an enemy state by Iran because of the because of its occupation and colonization of the Palestinian people. Yet, for the past 45 years, despite all of the very strong rhetoric that we heard and saw coming from Tehran, Iran has not launched a single attack directly against against Israel. Now, you know, we might say that there have been some attacks by Iranian partners, or some might say proxies, etc. But Iran itself has not launched a single direct attack against Israel until Saturday night. So clearly, the attack on the consulate was too much to bear and was also kind of the last straw on the camel's back.
Thanks for that background info. So getting back to Iran, what do you think was Iran trying to achieve with its drone strike on Israel? And which consequences should we observe in the near future in the region following this response from Iran?
Well, as I said, Iran, the first thing to note is that Iran didn't intend that to be the beginning of a war. Before all of the missiles even reached Israel, the Iranian ambassador at the United Nations informed the United Nations that as far as Iran was concerned, the matter was now concluded, in his words, meaning that there was an attack on the consulate. Iran has responded, as is its right under international law, its right to self-defense under Article 51 of the UN Charter, and it was done. That was over as far as Iran was concerned. So from its perspective, the matter has been ended. The manner that Iran chose to respond, I think, is also interesting. We know that Iran has fairly sophisticated weapons, sophisticated missiles, etc., but they chose to use very low-level weaponry, drones that take 5 to 6 hours to reach Israel, cruise missiles that took about 2 hours to reach there, and then a few ballistic missiles that took a little, that were a bit faster to get there, but all of which could easily be tracked and frankly easily intercepted, and you know, most of them were. Their targets clearly were two military bases, rather than a kind of general attack on Israel. So again, a clear message being sent. The military base that the Israelis admit had sustained some damage was the one from which the F-35s took off in order to launch the attack on the consulate in Damascus on the 1st of April. So all of this was very carefully chosen and decided on. From the Iranian perspective, they wanted to send a message, which they did, that they will no longer sit back if they are attacked by Israel. But I think that there's also a strategic issue in their choices here. If we consider that these weapons that were used are fairly low level and not very expensive to produce and use, the Iranians say that the entire operation cost them a few million dollars. The Israelis say that the interception cost them $1.3 billion. That's what it cost Israel. That's apart from the cost incurred by the United States that intercepted a number of those from Jordan and from Syria, from bases that the U.S. has in Syria. So the cost of the interception, probably approaches about $2 billion. The cost of the attack itself was a few million dollars. What Iran also did from a strategic military perspective is that it forced Israel to expose the full array of its surface-to-air interception mechanisms. So we saw Israel using the Iron Dome, David Sling, Arrow 2 and Arrow 3, which from the Iranian perspective gives them a better idea of the capabilities of these defensive weapons. Up to now, we all know of the use of the Iron Dome against particularly rockets coming from Gaza. But the others, we didn't see them in action really until now. So for the Iranians, I think that it was calculated from a diplomatic and political perspective, but also calculated from a military perspective. The second part of your question, I think, is more interesting, and that is what happens next. The Iranians say the matter is concluded. Do the Israelis accept that and say, fine, we attacked you, you attacked us back, let us get back to business, dealing with whatever else we have to deal with? The Israelis have said no. Their security cabinet meeting a few days ago said that they will respond, basically begin a new cycle of aggression against Iran, that they will at a time of their choosing. Which means that they seem determined in order to attack Iran again. We must note that they've proven, the current Israeli government has proven itself not to be a rational actor, very ideologically driven, driven by racism, certainly hatred of the Iranians and hatred of the Palestinians. And that judgment, and I think that, there's a chance that they will act very irrationally. On the other hand, the Iranians, who for the past 45 years have shown that they are a very rational actor politically and militarily, their comment was that if Israel embarks on new aggression, then they will respond to that, and they will respond in a much harsher way than they did on Saturday night. So Saturday night was a message, but if there's a new round of aggression, then it will be serious retaliation. If that happens, I think that we would be at the cusp of a possible regional war that could engulf the region, bring in other players into the mix, and possibly go beyond the region and bring players outside the region, such as the United States, into the mix. And we could be looking at an extremely messy situation.
Iran's side is out of question. I think you've analyzed that pretty well. Let's take a closer look at Israel. Well, like you mentioned, prior to Iran's drone attack on Israel, Israel launched a strike on Iran's embassy in Syria, thereby targeting two sovereign states at the same time. Why do you think Netanyahu decided to go ahead with this move? What do you think led him to that decision?
Well, the one thing is that over the past decade, the numerous attacks by Israel on Iran in Syria, so two states, two sovereign states, met with no response from the Iranians, none at all. In fact, many observers wondered why that was the case. And so from the Israeli government's perspective, it seemed that they could be as brazen as they liked and get away with it. Secondly, the fact that they have the U.S. Guarding their back. I mean, the U.S. even positioned two of their aircraft carrier groups in the Mediterranean in order to protect Israel after the 7th of October, makes them even more brazen and believe that they can operate with complete impunity. And thirdly, because I do believe, as I said earlier, that Israel has proven, or the current Israeli government at least, has proven to be a very irrational actor in terms of geopolitics and militarily. And I think that, and many commentators have argued, that the Israeli government actually does want a regional conflagration. They want to draw Iran into a war that could engulf the region, and particularly force the United States to then come in on Israel's side against Iran. And hopefully, from the Israeli perspective, that will help to destroy Iran once and for all. So I think that from the Israeli perspective, they do want a regional war, which they believe they will win with American support. And so, you know, all of the attacks against Iranian military personnel, for example, got no response. So they upped the ante a bit and attacked a consulate. And now they got a response. And so their response to Saturday night is to say, we will escalate. And I think that they hope that a real escalation will take place, not something like Saturday night.
All right. Thank you very much. Look, immediately after the Israeli missile attack on the Iranian consulate, the Iranian authorities demanded condemnation of this illegal action. However, we didn't see any of that happen from the international community. The US and the Western countries specifically, instead of condemning this attack, suggested that Iran should not respond to Israel. Do you think the West realizes the danger of its inaction?
Well, it was inaction then, after the 1st of April attacks, and then great action after Iran responded. You know, the Western powers reined themselves behind Israel. Sorry. Condemned Iran for responding, etc. A clear kind of double standard, a clear kind of hypocrisy coming into play. And we should also just remember that in the late 1990s, it was, there was another attack on an Iranian consulate, and this was in Afghanistan, when the Taliban at the time directly attacked an Iranian consulate and killed, I think it was 13 diplomats, not even military personnel, but diplomats. The United Nations Security Council convened to discuss it and issued a condemnation of the Taliban and Afghanistan. Iran's response at that time was that they were satisfied with the condemnation and they let the matter rest. Today, there's actually a friendly relationship between Iran and the Taliban. I believe that on the 2nd of April, if the United Nations Security Council convened and condemned Israel for the attack, we would not have seen Saturday night. Iran would have accepted the condemnation as being a fair response from the international community, and the matter would have been left. But the Security Council and the Western powers within it in particular, so not including the elected members and not including Russia and China, decided that that wasn't going to happen. There was going to be no condemnation of Israel. And instead, the victim in this case would be forced, they believed, not to respond. When the victim did respond, they came out with their, as I say, very hypocritical kind of comments about that. So Western powers are increasingly showing their hypocrisy, their double standard, but more importantly, their complete disregard for international law when that international law favors those who are not their allies and favors those who they don't like, in this case, Iran. International law, it seems, for many Western powers, applies to themselves when they're fighting amongst each other, certainly does not apply to countries of the global south. So, you know, you can look as well at the responses, for example, to the 7th of October attacks by the Palestinian resistance in Gaza, in Israel, the responses to that by Western powers, and then the responses by Western powers to Israel's genocide in Gaza. In both cases, the Palestinians are made out to be the perpetrators. In the first case, in the case of the 7th of October, in Western media and Western political halls, the 7th of October is made to seem much worse than the genocide currently unfolding, with 40,000 people having been killed and potentially hundreds of thousands more in the firing line. So certainly the response to this whole issue of Iran and Israel kind of highlights again that double standard and hypocrisy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like you said, could you perhaps compare as well the West reaction to what happened last weekend to that of countries in the Middle East? Did we see a similar reaction, or did some countries react differently? What did different parts of the world have to say about the situation?
Well, countries in the Middle East, I mean, Arab countries in particular, Basically, the majority of them are aligned to the United States and will not only not say anything critical of the US and its allies, now in this case, Israel, but as we saw, were happy to actually assist the United States. So the interception of the Iranian weaponry from Jordan, for example, certainly by Americans, but from Jordan with Jordanian assistance and approval. Similarly, Saudi Arabia has been clear that it would also assist if required. So from the Arab states in West Asia, you know, these are states that in general, not all of them, but in general are allies or proxies of the United States and took their position in that regard. There are a couple of Arab states, of course, that don't feel the same way. Algeria is one of them, Arab and African, of course. And then other states in the Middle East, Turkey, for example, issued much weaker condemnation than they could have about the issue, but they also made it clear that they will not allow their airspace or the American or the NATO airbase in Turkey to be used against Iran. They're a neighbor of Iran. Of course, it has direct repercussions for them. In the rest of the global south, in general, there has been criticism of the attack on the Iranian consulate on the 1st of April. The response to Saturday night, to Iran's response, has been much more muted. Some countries quietly expressing that Iran had a right to do what it did, but many states are careful that they don't want to overstep the mark in terms of being so critical that it upsets the Americans. South Africa, for example, my own country, now is finding out what it means to upset the Americans and American allies with the case that South Africa launched at the International Court of Justice. The kind of American response has been not very pleasant. I mean, there was a bill being prepared for Congress to sanction South Africa, for example. It's been withdrawn, of course. But those are the kinds of things that we expect will continue to happen. And other countries of the global south are seeing that and are worried that if they speak out too strongly, they will also get sanctioned by the US in particular.
Look, and in terms of this political bullying, what do you think can put an end to it, or perhaps restrain at least to some degree?
Well, certainly at the moment, multilateral institutions are not able to stop this kind of bullying. And that is mainly because of the power of certain states. In the Security Council, for example, so you could have a resolution in the General Assembly where, you know, all but five states support that particular resolution, but it would go nowhere because it'll get vetoed in the Security Council by the United States. When we talk about Israel, by the United States in particular. I mean, the last resolution we saw where 14 out of the 15 members of the United States, including four of the non-elected or so-called permanent members, voted in a particular way, and one abstained, and that was the United States. And despite the fact that it wasn't even vetoed, the Security Council is not able to do anything about its resolution because the United States, even though it abstained, will not allow any action to be taken on the basis of that resolution. So at the multilateral level, the only time we can talk about this kind of bullying of smaller and less powerful states by the more powerful ones being addressed and dealt with is if we have a firm and proper restructuring and reorganization of how these multilateral institutions work. If we ensure, for example, that the UN Security Council does not have five non-elected members who have a veto, that it is a more democratic structure like the General Assembly is, for example, number one. Number two, that at a broader, not in terms of the UN and these multilateral institutions, but at a broader global level, what we need in order to counter this kind of bullying is a stronger kind of balance of power that ensures that we live in a world that truly is multilateral and not with one very strong power that is able to dictate to both its allies and others. I mean, if we consider that the United States has the largest military budget in the world, that in the top 10 of those, you know, the highest military budgets, the U.S.'s military budget is more than the other nine put together. Then we're talking about a global situation that is very imbalanced, very unbalanced. And I think that a more multilateral future is what we should be looking at or for.
Yeah, I totally agree with you there, sir. Perhaps I'm sidestepping, but let's try connect some sort of analogy, perhaps. In the ongoing conflict in Ukraine, we've seen a similar scenario when, after the Kiev regime strike on the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant recently, U.S. State Department official Miller, I believe is his surname, commenting on this dangerous incident, for some reason urged Russia to refrain from any action that could lead to a nuclear threat, yet no condemnation for Ukraine. How does this approach reflect the double standards of Western policy that you mentioned?
No, I think the manner in which Western powers and early on Western populations have responded to the Ukraine crisis, I think is very indicative of this kind of double standard. And in fact, Ukraine made it very stark. So, of course, there's lots of comparisons about how Western powers have responded to Ukraine versus the genocide in Gaza. On the one hand, condemning Russia, on the other hand, supporting the Israeli genocide itself. But you might remember that in 2022, just after the crisis erupted in Ukraine, the kind of responses we saw, not only from Western politicians, but from Western media, from kind of popular influences in the media, etc. Many of us in Africa took that kind of response extremely seriously. Very racist responses, the kind of statement about, well, you know, we can't bear to see this happening. These people are like us, blue-eyed and blonde-haired. I mean, this is a quote, blue-eyed and blonde-haired.
Oh, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
You know, these are civilized refugees, not like, you know, from Iraq or...
From Middle East and Africa, yeah.
Or Afghanistan, or from Africa, for that matter, because, you know, at the same time, Europe is building walls against Africans. And for many of us in Africa in particular, but in the global south in general, I think, the Ukraine crisis brought out very starkly what this kind of double standard means for us. That, in fact, if you're not European, then your humanity is not the same. You might face the same kind of trials and tribulations, even the same kind of aggression by another power. But if you are blue-eyed and blonde-haired, then you deserve to be treated better as a refugee. You deserve to get more aid. You deserve to be welcomed and embraced. But if you're darker-skinned, then stay where you are and die. I think that certainly the Ukraine issue highlighted that very starkly for many of us.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you, sir. Lastly, what implications, just because our time is running a bit short, what implications for the global arena does this direct confrontation between Iran and Israel have? And what stance are African countries expected to take given the changing power dynamics in the region?
So it all depends on how Israel or what Israel decides to do. If Israel decides to adopt an aggressive attitude and attack Iran, then I think that we could have a situation where, I mean, we're not going to have a world war, but we would have a situation where there'll be a regional war and global powers will be drawn in whether they like it or not. Whether they like it or not, for example, Russia certainly does not want to see a regional war taking place. Firstly, because, Russia is involved in a messy situation in Syria already in the region. But, more importantly, I think Russia is involved in a big crisis in Ukraine. You don't want to open up too many fronts. So regional war is not something that anyone wants, not even the United States wants such a war, but Israel certainly wants to drag the US into it. And so if Israel adopts an aggressive attitude, attacks Iran, I think we will see a situation where not only regional but also global powers will be involved. For the African continent, it would be a very challenging situation. There are a number of African states over the past few years having been lobbied and provided all kinds of military and intelligence, etc., support by Israel and the United States have become very amenable to Israel in the past. And that's why we saw, for example, the number of African states that have supported Israel's bid for observer status at the African Union. But I think that if such a war erupts in the Middle East region, African states will be forced to take a principled position. And I think that the African Union will have no choice but to take the right side on this issue, which is to condemn Israel's actions.
As always, the conversation about Africa's role in the world is ongoing. If you have any thoughts on the Iran-Israel situation or any other issue we discussed, feel free to reach out. You can always find us on Telegram, Sputnik Africa. Likewise, enjoy detailed articles on the Sputnik Africa website. Don't forget to take a look at the previous Afro Verdict episodes on popular podcasting platforms such as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Deezer, Pocket Casts, AfriPods, CastBox, and Podcast Addict. Afro Verdict is now also on Spotify, so if that's your go-to platform for podcasts, enjoy Afro Verdict anytime. As always, this is your host, Victor Anakin. Thank you for tuning in and listening. And as always, until the next episode.
Afro Verdict, brought to you by Sputnik Africa.